one of these on. If some of you have come for the first time or have not been in all the sessions, what we did originally was to take some time in form of an introduction to the book, considering the historical circumstances in which it was written, who it was revealed to. And then we examined how the Guardian had characterized the importance of studying the book and something about the central themes that he has suggested in God Passes By that constitute a part of, if you will, the major parts or major points of the book itself. In the meanwhile, we've passed out a sequential outline of the text. Are any of you here that didn't get the sequential outline last week? Somebody left it. Also, if you weren't here last week, you haven't gotten the questions. There's a list of suggested questions related to the first two sections of part one. Can somebody else go help me? While we're at it, there's a list of the major themes from the Kitab-e-Ghan. Once we get those passed out. There's more sequential outlines. You still have some? Any of you that didn't get the list of major themes from the Ghan? Is somebody that needs that? I'm going to ask Andisha if she would read some of the remaining passages from the gleanings, the sections of the gleanings from the Ghan, those passages which are in the first 50 pages of the text, which we're considering as the first unit of study, if you will.
Page 11 to 12. American. Consider Moses, armed with the rod of celestial dominion, adorned with the white hand of divine knowledge, and proceeding from the Paran of the love of God, and wielding the serpent of power and everlasting majesty, he shone forth from the Sinai of light upon the world. He summoned all the peoples and kindreds of the earth to the kingdom of eternity and invited them to partake of the fruit of the tree of faithfulness. Surely you are aware of the fierce opposition of Pharaoh and his people, and of the stones of idle fancy which the hands of the infidels cast upon that blessed tree. So much so that Pharaoh and his people finally arose and exerted their utmost endeavor to extinguish with the waters of falsehood and denial the fire of that sacred tree, oblivious of the truth that no earthly water can quench the flames of divine wisdom, nor mortal blasts extinguish the lamp of everlasting dominion. Nay, rather, such water cannot but intensify the burning of the flame, and such blasts cannot but ensure the preservation of the lamp. will ye to observe with the eye of discernment and walk in the way of God's holy will and pleasure. And when the days of Moses were ended, and the light of Jesus, shining forth from the dayspring of the Spirit, encompassed the world, all the people of Israel arose in protest against him. They clamored that he whose advent the Bible had foretold must needs promulgate and fulfill the laws of Moses, whereas this youthful Nazarene, who laid claim to the station of the divine Messiah, had annulled the laws of divorce and of the Sabbath day, the most weighty of all the laws of Moses. Moreover, what of the signs of the manifestation yet to come? These people of Israel are even unto the present day still expecting that manifestation of holiness which the Bible hath foretold. How many manifestations of holiness, how many revealers of the light everlasting have appeared since the time of Moses, and yet Israel, wrapped in the densest veils of satanic fancy and false imaginings, is still expectant that the idol of her own handiwork will appear with such signs as she herself hath conceived. Thus hath God laid hold of them for their sins, hath extinguished in them the spirit of faith, and tormented them with the flames of the nethermost fire. And this for no other reason except that Israel refused to apprehend the meaning of such words as have been revealed in the Bible concerning the signs of the coming revelation. As she never grasped their true significance, and to outward seeming, such events never came to pass, she therefore remained deprived of recognizing the beauty of Jesus and of beholding the face of God. And they still await his coming. From time immemorial, even unto this day, all the kindreds and peoples of the earth have clung to such fanciful and unseemly thoughts, and thus have deprived themselves of the clear waters streaming from the springs of purity and holiness. The next one from 20 to 22. To them that are endowed with understanding, it is clear and manifest that when the fire of the love of Jesus consumed the veils of Jewish limitations, and his authority was made apparent and partially enforced, he, the revealer of the unseen beauty, addressing one day his disciples, referred unto his passing, and kindling in their hearts the fire of bereavement, said unto them, I go away and come again unto you. And in another place he said, I go and another will come, who will tell you all that I have not told you, and will fulfill all that I have said. Both these sayings have but one meaning. Will ye to ponder upon the manifestation of the unity of God with divine insight? Every discerning observer will recognize that in the dispensation of the Quran, both the book and the cause of Jesus were confirmed. As to the matter of names, Muhammad himself declared, I am Jesus. He recognized the truth of the signs, prophecies, and words of Jesus, and testified that they were all of God. In this sense, neither the person of Jesus nor his writings hath differed from that of Muhammad and of his holy book, inasmuch as both have championed the cause of God, uttered his praise, and revealed his commandments. Thus it is that Jesus himself declared, I go away and come again unto you. Consider the sun. Were it to say now, I am the sun of yesterday, it would speak the truth. And should it, bearing the sequence of time in mind, claim to be other than that sun, it still would speak the truth. In like manner, if it be said that all the days were but one and the same, it is correct and true. And if it be said, with respect to their particular names and designations, that they differ, that again is true. For though they are the same, yet one doth recognize in each a separate designation, a specific attribute, a particular character. Conceive accordingly the distinction, variation, and unity characteristic of the various manifestations of holiness, that thou mayest comprehend the allusions made by the Creator of all names and attributes to the mysteries of distinction and unity, and discover the answer to thy question as to why that everlasting beauty should have, at sundry times, called himself by different names and titles.
After taking a look at the sequential outline, see for part one. These titles will give us some clue to the flow of the text. We have these passages on detachment as the key to true understanding, and then the requirements, the initial setting forth of the requirements of those who tread the path of faith. This is echoed and expanded, of course, later on in the passages about the true seeker. That words and deeds of men are no standard for understanding the recognition of God and his prophets. The cause of the denial of the prophets of the past, and the comment about the Surah of Hud and how it would suffice anyone. Then the accounts of the cruelties suffered by the prophets of the past. Noah, and there's mention of this non-fulfillment of the divine promise, which we'll come back to shortly. Hud, Saleh, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. Then he deals with the denials of religious leaders, some 5 pages there. Later refers to the unfoldment of the mysteries of the verses. Then about the coming and return of the prophets, which of course is this passage we were just reading, and the distinction, variation, and unity of the prophets. He deals again with food and bread, and then begins this explanation of the passage from Matthew, and talks about repression as an essential feature of every revelation, and then these sub-themes, the highest purpose of creation, the sun and moon interpreted, sons of truth, and this is the meaning of sun and moon, sons of truth, religious leaders, laws and teachings, prayer and fasting, the darkening of the sun and the moon, cleaving of the heaven. To consider the hardship and bitterness of the lives of the prophets, the changing of the earth, and knowledge is a light. All these themes are touched upon in this first section. We read that. It brings us back to it. Now, there's no time, unless we're going to have a class that lasts a year or more, to deal with the contents of each page. But with the classes in the past, we've built up some annotations, some notes that explain some background on some of the points and subjects which are have been the object of questions. You may also have some questions that you would wish to ask. I'll move along through the text. If you have questions on something that we're passing, ask them. If not, I'll share with you a little of the notes that we have as a class, and we'll see how that works. In summarizing the whole of part one, one could say that it centers on the importance of detachment and attaining to true understanding of God and his prophets. It has an account of the cruelty suffered by the divine messengers. It refers to the consequences of man blindly following religious leaders and not searching out truth for themselves. It relates to the exalted station of the manifestations of God. refers to the method of God in trying his servants to distinguish the sincere from the false. And due to the relativity of religious truth as well as the continuity of divine revelation. So you'll see how this relates to some of the major themes that we were reading in that other list. Just to start off, it's interesting to note that Baha'u'llah has headed the book with, "In the name of our Lord, the Exalted, the Most High." Now, this in Arabic is Aliyul Allah, and it's these are the names of God most often associated with the Bab. And they've been incorporated by Shoghi Effendi as part of the battle cry animating the heroes and heroines of the 10-year crusade. He says that Ya Baha'u'llah, Ya Aliyul Allah is the battle cry of the Baha'i heroes and heroines. Of course, we know one refers to Baha'u'llah, and this other one, Ya Aliyul Allah, refers to the Bab. You can find the reference to that in Messages to the Baha'i World, page 153. You can also see this echoed on page 229 at the chapter, at the paragraph break, "The Bab, the Lord, the Most Exalted." And in the obligatory prayers, this comes up again, which is an interesting commentary. I can't remember the first part of it. Referring to the divine essence, the most exalted, the all-glorious. Now again, this is the Aliyul Abha. This is the name of the Bab in the name of Baha'u'llah. It talks about the appearance of the most great name in these names, the appearance of the essence of God in these divine names. And it's in that case, it's translated as the most exalted, the all-glorious, or the most high, the all-glorious, the most glorious. It has a variety of expressions in English. But I see in this a reference back to the appearance of God in these two great names. Just for your scholastic information, the paragraph, "No man shall attain," this paragraph that's in smaller typeface here, as well as the one that begins part two, are in Arabic. The text of the Adhan is in Persian. When Baha'u'llah cites the Bible or the Quran, he cites naturally the Arabic versions, the Arabic version of the Quran. He does likewise with the Gospels. When he quotes them, he's quoting in Arabic. And this is why at times he quotes and then he seems to be explaining exactly what's just been said. And you wonder, well, it's so clear, why is he repeating himself? It's because he's explaining it in Persian. And that's now been translated into English. So some of us, as we may observe that phenomenon, is a reason for it. It also gives you a chance to see how he really interprets the original meaning of the text, whatever the Arabic may say and whatever the English translated from the Arabic may say. This whole question of true understanding and certitude is a major one. There's lots of comments we could make on that, but maybe we'll give a little bit of this and then move on to more specific points. Man's attainment to true understanding is one of the essential animating purposes of creation. Such divine knowledge, such comprehension, wisdom, and recognition, as emphasized in the Adhan, is not dependent upon acquired human learning. Rather, true understanding is in the nature of light from the sun of divine knowledge, which shines from the prophets of God and is reflected in the heart of man, endowing it with recognition of truth and inspiring it with the comprehension of spiritual realities. It makes clear, it makes apparent, it makes explicit the forms of things which without that light we would not perceive. As it is said, "Knowledge is a light which God casteth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth." Very different concept from the knowledge in the outside world. Knowledge is a light that God casteth into the heart of whomsoever he will. Can you imagine how important prayer is for the attainment of knowledge? You want to get God's attention. You want to ask His favors. You want Him to fill your heart with that knowledge, which is this knowledge that He speaks of, the light. Note the spiritual prerequisites in this case: detachment and sanctity of soul, which are necessary for a true comprehension of divine revelation. The requirement of virtue in connection with the attainment of knowledge and insight is the recurring truths of the Agon. The requirement of virtue in connection with the attainment of knowledge and insight is a recurrent theme of the Agon, and one of the truths that Baha'u'llah presses home. So we wonder why we don't understand more, and we have to consider this question: our own spiritual state, our own degree of detachment, our own level of sanctity, our own attainment to the qualities and the expression of these names and attributes of God that the prophets of God bring. All of that will increase our awareness. It will open to us worlds of vision and wisdom undreamt of. This is the promise of this book. It's clear that people differ in regard to the degree of true understanding which they have attained. Abdul Baha'u'llah tablet comments on the relative character of this understanding and establishes that no matter how high the soaring ones fly in the utmost degrees of knowledge and comprehension, no matter how near the worshippers of the one true God ascend towards the summits of certitude, they are but reading letters from the book of their own selves, reaching only to the brilliant unseen signs that are enshrined in the reality of their own beings, and circling round the center of their own entities. He further emphasizes that the degrees which are beyond their realms of understanding shall never be perceived nor understood by them. But there is so much latent in the human soul that we never finish in that discovery. And what is latent there, primarily it would seem, is the capacity to capture, to receive light that's filled with images, that is, with meanings, that reflects on the human soul, and then we read and observe that as it appears in our own being. Somehow the fabric of our being is dyed and cast and changed and transformed, one understanding and perception after another, through the divine influence that surrounds us. Abdu'l-Bahá says in another place, he says that the knowledge we have of God is this knowledge as it appears in our own beings, and he says that it's like a compass. Our understanding has a place, and that is our own reality. And however far we can circle with the compass of our being, however much we take in, the center of it is always our own soul, our own consciousness, not the consciousness of God, not the consciousness of Baha'u'llah. This is why we never transcend our station, if you will. We may transcend our state, but not our station. That is the station of the human soul and the ultimate station of the illumined, sanctified human soul. But that becomes sufficient center for the reception of divine wisdom and knowledge as to make it the acme of creation, the highest point of creation, the sign of both worlds, the outer world and the inner worlds of God. He mentions here on the first page, perhaps the Scutari too, in that opening paragraph, to be detached from all that is in heaven and on earth. People say, well, why should we be detached from what's in heaven? Isn't that what we're after anyway, what we should be looking for? Desire for either earthly goods or heavenly treasures constitutes an improper motive for seeking God's good pleasure. The Bab in the Bayan states, if thy gaze should be on paradise, and thou shouldst worship him while cherishing such a hope, thou wouldst make God's creation a partner with him, notwithstanding the fact that paradise is desired by me. With regard to Bayan, it means generally utterance and explanation, you'll see in the title, according to the dispensations of providence, has been raised in the firmament of the Bayan. And in the Bab's writings, it's oftentimes specifically the Persian Bayan, which is referred to, But also he says there that the Bayan refers to all of his writings. And this is confirmed again by Baha'u'llah in Prayers and Meditations on page 285. He said, should anyone consider thy books which thou didst name the Bayan and ponder in his heart what has been revealed therein, he would discover that each of these books announceth my revelation. So again he gives the idea of multiple books, not just the Persian Bayan and the Arabic Bayan, but all of the writings of it. This term, they that tread the path of faith, these are the wayfarers in the path of faith, have been defined in Islamic mysticism as those who have freed themselves from vain imaginings, who have subdued the animal side of their nature, and have set foot on the way of faith, and by the aid of God, after passing the seven valleys or cities, as explained in the seven valleys, attain the object of their quest. Certitude we discussed in an earlier class, this question of standard, a standard by which to weigh things, the principle of reference to the revealed word of God as the balance in determining the truth of things is most powerfully stated by Baha'u'llah in his most holy book, in the Kitab al-Aqdas, where he says, weigh not the book of God with such standards and sciences as are current amongst you, for the book itself is the unerring balance established amongst men. In this most perfect balance, whatsoever the people and kindreds of the earth possess must be weighed, while the measure of its weight should be tested according to its own standard. Did ye but know? On page 4 we have the first reference, if people would come to, on the manifestations of God. Yearningly awaited the advent of the manifestations of God in the sanctified persons of his chosen ones. In a parallel tablet echoing truths of the Adon, Baha'u'llah, we're all familiar that of course this refers to the messengers of God such as Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, the Bab, and Baha'u'llah himself. He says, in the kingdom of earth and heaven there must needs be manifested a being, an essence, who shall act as a manifestation and vehicle for the transmission of the grace of the divinity itself, the sovereign Lord of all. Through the teachings of this day star of truth, every man will advance and develop until he attaineth the stations at which he can manifest all the potential forces with which his inmost true self hath been endowed. And then again in another place he says, the person of the manifestation hath ever been the representative and mouthpiece of God. He in truth is the day spring of God's most excellent titles and the dawning place of his exalted attributes. See the gleanings, page 66 and page 70. And more about the nature of the manifestation, if you want to make cross-references there, are pages 33-34 of the Egon, and 67 of the Egon, and 103 of the Egon. We have a reference towards the end of that paragraph about the face of God himself. The face of the manifestation. The face of God himself. In this regard, Baha'u'llah proclaims, this is the day whereon naught can be seen except the splendors of the light that shineth from the face of thy Lord, the gracious, the most bountiful. He who from everlasting hath concealed his face from the sight of creation is now come. And again he says, O leaders of religion, who is the man amongst you that can rival me in vision or insight? Where is he to be found that dareth to claim to be my equal in utterance or wisdom? No, by my Lord the All-Merciful, all on the earth shall pass away. And this is the face of your Lord, the Almighty, the Well-Beloved. This is from Gleanings, page 2931 and 199, first prequel. He refers to the Surah of Hud. He says to them that are possessed of true understanding and insight, the Surah of Hud surely sufficeth. ponder a while those holy words in your heart, and with utter detachment, strive to grasp their meaning. Examine the wondrous behavior of the prophets, and recall the defamations and denials uttered by the children of negation and falsehood. Perchance you may cause the bird of the human heart to wing its flight away from the abodes of heedlessness and doubt into the nest of faith and certainty, and drink deep from the pure waters of ancient wisdom, and partake of the fruit of the tree of divine knowledge, such as the share of the pure in heart of the bread that hath descended from the realms of eternity and holiness. Now, the surah of Hud is one of the surahs of the Quran, the 11th surah of the Quran. It contains 123 verses, and it recounts the successive calls of God's prophets and messengers to diverse peoples and the dire consequences which befall them after they reject the prophets of God. It shows this as a recurring cycle or process. We'll come to identifying who in a little while after. You can go into the study of the quality of negation and what it consists of and the meaning of letters of negation. We won't go into it today, but there are places to look for that. The reference to the human heart as a bird, the bird of the human heart, a suggestive image. You remember in Hidden Words, he says, "Wings I have bestowed upon thee that thou mayest fly to the realms of mystic holiness, and not the regions of satanic fancy." We're told that if a bird is always soaring higher, its progress will be continual. But if it relaxes in its efforts, it will necessarily descend toward the earth. Bread, the image of bread. Here we have the inner meaning of manna from heaven as found in past scriptures. In another place, Baha'u'llah says, "That which is preeminent above all other gifts and incorruptible in nature and pertaineth to God himself is the gift of divine revelation. Every bounty conferred by the Creator upon man, be it material or spiritual, is subservient unto this. It is in its essence and will ever so remain the bread which cometh down from heaven. He hath indeed partaken of this highest gift of God, who hath recognized his manifestation in this day." Congratulations. At least we got that far, didn't we? Some of these other things are more tantalizing. In the Tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá, he writes one of the believers, "Thank God that thou wert fed from the table which hath descended from heaven. That food is, quote, 'I am the bread which descended from heaven,' recorded in the Gospel. That is to say, faith, certainty, love, and knowledge." Under description of the bread, there it is. Faith, certainty, love, and knowledge. Tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá, Volume 3, page 6, 7, 7. Now you'll notice that from what we read, and here on page 6, I better get to that part about Noah and his ark before we all float away here. See on page 6 the paragraph, "Should you acquaint yourself with the indignities heaped upon the prophets of God and apprehend the true causes of the objections voiced by their oppressors, you will surely appreciate the significance of their position." Now, he makes an interesting promise, he says, "Moreover, the more closely you observe the denials of those who have opposed the manifestations of the divine attributes, the firmer will be your faith in the cause of God." So accordingly, he says, he will give us some diverse accounts here of the suffering of the manifestation, things that happened to him. To demonstrate the truth that throughout all ages and centuries, the manifestations of power and glory have been subjected to such heinous cruelties that no pen dare describe them. Perchance this may enable a few to cease to be perturbed by the clamor and protestations of the divines and foolish of this age, and cause them to strengthen their confidence and certainty. Now you recall the uncle of the Bab was saying, well, how, if this is the promised one, why was he was subjected to these cruelties? Why was he taken off? Why was he martyred? Why was he imprisoned? They thought of their Qayyim as being triumphant, as coming with the sovereignty of God, that is, with the government of God, to rule all peoples. And it was just the opposite happened to the Bab, as far as he could see. The second part of the Quran goes into this question of the implications and meaning of sovereignty, spiritual sovereignty, as mentioned and promised in the Holy Quran. Parallel to this is a very interesting passage in the beginning, pages 57, 58. Thou hast known how grievously the prophets of God, his messengers and chosen ones, have been afflicted. Meditate a while on the motive and reason which have been responsible for such a persecution. At no time, no dispensation, have the prophets of God escaped the blasphemy of their enemies, the cruelty of their oppressors, the denunciation of the learned of their age, who appeared in the guise of uprightness and piety. Day and night they passed through such agonies as none can ever measure, except the knowledge of the one true God, exalted be his glory. And again, such hath been the perversity of men and their transgressions, so grievous have been the trials that have afflicted the prophets of God and their chosen ones, that all mankind deserveth to be tormented and to perish. God's hidden and most loving providence, however, hath, through both visible and invisible agencies, protected and will continue to protect it from the penalty of its wickedness. That was page 76 of Durham. Now, Baha'u'llah begins the brief accounts of the ministries of a number of the prophets, and he starts with Noah. I think, you know, on your own, you can study if you want to find the Quranic references to Noah. You find a good Quran and an index. I don't need to read all these out. And also the biblical ones. They're all there. They're interesting to read about and see what the background was. In this connection, Shoghi Effendi has written a letter on his behalf. He says, the ark and the flood, we believe, are symbolical. For those of you that are familiar with the traditional stories. Now, among the prophets was Noah, page 7. For 950 years he prayerfully exhorted his people. It's a long life, wasn't it? Someone fortunately asked the guardian about this. The guardian advises that the period of 950 years referred to in the Quran as the time Noah exhorted the people refers to the period of his ministry. The term year does not refer to a period of time such as our year. It was entirely different, and thus does not extend over any such period as our present term year would imply. This is a letter dated 3rd March 1957. Approximately 6,000 years have elapsed since the appearance of Adam. The ages of the prophets specified in the Bible were based on a different calculation than the one used at present. The years mentioned in the Bible were different from ours. This is 26 January 1939. It's interesting to note that the Bible makes no reference of Noah until he is said to be 500 years old, when he begets three sons. Genesis 5:32. There is a reference here, page 7, such pain and suffering. Where is that? All right. In None, however, heeded his call. Each day they inflicted on his blessed person such pain and suffering that no one believed he could survive. According to a tradition attributed to the Imam Sadiq, Noor was several times so badly beaten by the infidels that his ears would gush with blood, and he would for a time lose consciousness. Noor's followers would beg him to ask God to punish the unbelievers, but Noor would instead pray for them. Further down in the stage, but when the hour struck, the divine promise was not fulfilled. Above that, he says, long afterwards, he several times promised victory to his companions and fixed the hour thereof, but when the hour struck, the divine promise was not fulfilled. This caused a few among the small number of his followers to turn away from him, and to this testify the records of the best-known books. You must certainly have perused, if not undoubtedly you will. We shall just a moment do that. Finally, as stated in books and traditions, there remained with him only 40 or 72 of his followers. At last, from the depth of his being, he cried aloud, "Lord, leave not upon the land a single dweller from among the unbelievers." Now, oftentimes questions arise with regard to the divine promise, the non-fulfillment of divine promises. This is a divine subject, if you will, that's referred to in different dispensations. And it has a name, Bada, which comes from the Arabic, which is the whole concept of non-fulfillment of a divine promise. The non-fulfillment of a prophetic announcement, the definition of this, is the non-fulfillment of a prophetic announcement due to a change in the divine purpose. It's an accepted theological principle in Islam and one confirmed in the Baha'i writings and by the Bab too. It's known as Bada from the Arabic in the original. With regard to the specific promise mentioned here and recorded in the best-known books, this refers to accounts in renowned Muslim traditions where it is related how God told Noah to inform his followers that after eating dates, they should plant the seeds, and that once these grew to fruition, divine punishment would descend on their enemies. The fresh fruits appeared, and Noah, when asked about the promised punishment, said that God wanted them to now plant the seeds of this new fruit. And when it bore dates, then the punishment would come. As stated in the Agan, this caused a few among the small number of his followers to turn away from him. The test, according to the traditions, was later repeated twice again with the same result. Finally, God's command came to build the ark, which would protect all those who had persevered through the tests, from the flood which would overtake the non-believers. In the Persian Bayan, the Bab explains that the non-fulfillment of a divine promise is another expression of God's power to do whatsoever he willeth. No one can oppose this because his decree is just. Non-fulfillment when it concerns creation is related to weakness and limitation on the part of the creatures. But when it is attributed to God, it is evidence of his might and power. 40 or 72 of his followers, say 40 or 50, but why does he say 40 or 72? The point is the fewness of Noah's followers after the trials described. Baha'u'llah here cites two different figures from the recorded traditions without giving a judgment as to which is the more accurate. Hud, Prophet Hud. And after Noah, the light of the countenance of Hud shone forth above the horizon of creation for well nigh 700 years, according to the sayings of men, exhorted the people to turn their faces and draw near unto the Rizwan of the divine presence. Hud is the first of five prophets of God mentioned in the Quran as having been sent to the peoples of Arabia. The others are Saleh, there's five of them, Hud, Saleh, Abraham, Shu'aib, and Muhammad. Hud came to the people of Ad. You can find the Quranic references in the index of the Quran easily to this. Ad is known as the grandson of Aram, who was the grandson of Noah. Now, the biblical scholars and Quranic scholars conjecture that Hud is possibly Eber of the Bible. You could see Genesis 10:24 for the connection of that. Saleh, mentioned in the next paragraph, is the second of these five prophets. And in this case, he was sent to the Samud tribe. Some commentators identify him with Saleh of Genesis, again 10:24. He's mentioned extensively in the Quran. According to Muslim tradition, Saleh began his prophetic mission when he was 16 and lived for 120 years. When Saleh was asked for a sign by the people who opposed him, God sent them a she-camel. You'll see references to the she-camel sometimes in various Baha'i tablets. Also, he mentions it specifically in the Epistle of the Son of the Wolf. Abdu'l-Bahá has explained that the she-camel mentioned in relation to Saleh's mission is a symbol of thy white she-camel and cause thy crimson ark to founder. So here Baha'u'llah also adapts it as an image of his own faith, the she-camel. In yet another passage he states, consider the she-camel, though but a beast, yet hath the All-Merciful exalted her to so high a station that the tongues of the earth made mention of her and celebrated her praise. The old cemetery in Akka surrounds Saleh's traditionally accepted resting place, the shrine of the Prophet Saleh, is in Akka. It was in the shadow of his modest shrine that both Mirza Mehdi, the son of Baha'u'llah, and Nawab, Mehdi's mother, and Baha'u'llah's wife were originally interred. Their remains have since been transferred to the Monument Gardens on Mount Carmel under the direction of Shoghi Effendi in the late 1930s. I remember Ruhia Khanum speaking about this. She said she had traveled to St. Catherine's Monastery in the south. And as they were riding up this very isolated road to the monastery, there was a small shrine on a hill, a small white domed building. And so some of the people asked her, what is that? And the tour guide said that it's the grave of the Prophet Saleh. So Khanum piped up and she said, I thought this was, that he was buried in Akka. And the man said, that's his summer resting place. Just to give you some idea that there is confusion as to where these prophets are buried. But the fact that Baha'u'llah had his son buried there and his wife buried there, I think is indicative of the importance and significance of it for us. The Samudic tribes, the tribe of Samud, or group of tribes, are said to have lived in northern Arabia. And
up to the southern border of Syria. They inhabited dwellings cut in the sides of mountains. There's inscriptions found all over Arabia in the Samudi language. And the religion suggests a one-time extension of the tribe's authority, especially in the north and central center of Arabia. Page 10, we have a reference to the friend of God with a note that shows that this is Abraham. Page 11, we refer to the episode of the fire. Up to now, page 11, do you have any other questions that you had that we haven't covered that you want to go back to? Is there anything you want to ask about there? Are you sure? Please feel free to ask if you have something. Episode of the fire. Baha'u'llah in the Gleanings echoes this passage. He says, "Behold how the people, as a result of the verdict pronounced by the divines of his age, have cast Abraham, the friend of God, into fire." It's found in the Gleanings, page 56. It states in the Quran, "They said, burn him and avenge your gods. If you do this, it will be well. And when Abraham was cast into the burning pile, we said, O fire, be thou cold, and a preservation unto Abraham." The traditions relate that by Nimrod's order, a large space was enclosed at Aritha, and filled with a vast quantity of wood, which being set on fire burned so fiercely that none dared venture near it. Then they bound Abraham and put him into an engine, shot him into the midst of the fire, from which he was preserved by the angel Gabriel, who was sent to his assistance, the fire burning only the cords with which he was bound. In other words, he was delivered in some miraculous manner by divine intervention. Now there's a lot of other traditions that go on with much more detail about how he was sitting there and surrounded by fresh fruits and was enjoying himself in the middle of the fire. You can find those if you want to search for them. But the whole idea, this is what this episode of the fire refers to, is that Abraham was thrown into the midst of fire and escaped miraculously from it, and then led his people in that banishment, banished, led the people, the promised people, here to the promised land, and from here down the coast of Arabia, where he founded Mecca, or at least he founded the temple at Mecca, and that's how he's really the father of both the Arabs and the Jews in that sense. You'll recall that he is an ancestor of Baha'u'llah through his wife Keturah, according to the affirmations of God Passes By and Histories Behind. Expelled from his city, Shoghi Effendi characterizes the banishment of Abraham from Ur of Chaldees to the Promised Land as a banishment which in its multitudinous benefits it conferred upon so many diverse peoples, faiths, and nations constitutes the nearest historical approach to the incalculable blessings destined to be vouchsafed in this day and in future ages to the whole human race, in direct consequence of the exile suffered by him whose cause is the flower and fruit of all previous revelations. The Old Testament refers to Ur of Chaldees as Abraham's native city. Abdu'l-Bahá himself, after enumerating in some answered questions the far-reaching consequences of Abraham's banishment, significantly affirms that since the exile of Abraham from Ur to Aleppo in Syria produced this result, we must consider what will be the effect of the exile of Baha'u'llah in his several removes. Moses, of course, is the interlocutor of God who laid down the Ten Commandments. He delivered the Israelites from their exile in Pharaoh's Egypt and led them to the promised land of Israel. There's an account of his life and his ministry in Some Answered Questions, chapter 5. The prophetic references on page 11 to the rod, the white hand, the Puran of the love of God, the serpent of power, and so on. Sinai of light. These are terms used figuratively, evoking the signs which Moses produced before Pharaoh and his court. For instance, in the Quran it says, "So he threw his rod, then lo, it was a serpent manifest. And he drew forth his hand out of his bosom, and behold, it appeared white unto the spectators. White and splendid," recounts an Islamic tradition, "surpassing the brightness of the sun." You remember this thing that in the Hidden Words, Baha'u'llah says, "Remove the hand from your breast." You know? It's echoing these same images. Baha'u'llah, with regard to himself, revealed, "This is mine hand which God hath turned white for all the worlds to behold. This is my staff, where it cast down it would, of a truth, swallow up all created things." This has been cited in God Passes By, page 169. Paran is a wilderness and a mountain mentioned in the Old Testament. A reference, Shoghi Effendi says, reference in the Bible to Mount Paran and Paraclete refers to Muhammad's revelation. Mount Sinai is the principal site of divine revelation in Jewish history, where Moses received the Ten Commandments. It's usually identified as Jabal Musa in the Sinai Peninsula. It's a massive granite pinnacle situated approximately in the center of the peninsula, the Sinai Peninsula. Mm-hmm. About which? Paran? About Paran? Mount Paran? It's either both a wilderness and a mountain mentioned in the Bible and the Quran. It's a reference in the Bible. Shoghi Effendi says, reference in the Bible to Mount Paran and Paraclete refers to Muhammad's revelation. Is that true? And the Puranic love? The Puran of love. Well, this, of course, is the outer form of it, and he uses them as symbols. I should imagine the Quran of love, the wilderness of love, I don't know, the mountain of love, the wilderness of love. That's the way we'd understand it. The serpent of power, what does he say here? The serpent of power and everlasting majesty. In other words, he's showing the symbolical character of the references in the holy books, or the traditional images that are set down in the scriptures. The fierce opposition of Pharaoh, of course this is the title of the ancient rulers of Egypt, the persecutors of Moses and his people. Abdu'l-Bahá affirms that the kingdom, wealth, and power of Pharaoh and his people, which were the causes of the life of the nation, became through their opposition, denial, and pride, the cause of death, destruction, dispersion, degradation, and poverty. Some Answered Questions, page 50, that comes from. You notice the references to cast upon that blessed tree, that sacred tree. Here we have the tree as a symbol of the manifestation of God. In other words, here Moses himself. This is the Sadrat al-Muntaha too, that the title Sadrat al-Muntaha refers to the blessed tree, the divine lot tree, the tree beyond which there is no passing. The tree in the seventh heaven, upon when Muhammad ascended through the heavens, he came to that tree and they said, beyond this there's no passing. The voice of God said, thus far and no farther. And it's the highest appearance of God, the highest expression of his manifestation. And Baha'u'llah identifies some of the previous prophets and certainly himself with this divine lote tree, this Sadrat tree, Sadrat al-Muntaha, the tree of the uttermost limit, you could say. Now he says that so much so that Pharaoh and his people finally rose and exerted their utmost endeavor to extinguish with the waters of falsehood and denial the fire of that sacred tree, oblivious of the truth that no earthly water can quench the flame of divine wisdom, nor mortal blasts extinguish the lamp of everlasting dominion. Nay, rather, such water cannot but intensify the burning of the flame, and such blasts cannot but ensure the preservation of the lamp, were ye to observe with the eye of discernment and walk in the way of God's holy will and pleasure. You can find a very interesting passage in Prayers and Meditations that deals with this question of fire and water and how it affects the manifestations. On page 150. Following that, we have a believer of the kindred of Pharaoh. It's said by traditions that this was the son of Pharaoh's uncle. Several Quranic commentaries assume that this believer was the same person who warned Moses to flee after the latter had slain an Egyptian. So he had a warning out of the court, you could say, of the Pharaoh, although he was himself part of the court. At the end of that paragraph, this self-same believer was put to a shameful death. And the traditions on this say, this is in traditions given by the Imams, they state that Pharaoh's people cut this believer in pieces. The divine protection vouchsafed to him, as mentioned in the Quran, as you see the verse, I don't know if that verse is here, I've forgotten this again. In any case, in the Quranic verses, he's promised divine protection, and this is mentioned in the Quran, and it's understood to mean that God kept him firm in the face of martyrdom. That was the protection, rather than protecting him from being killed. The bottom of the page, he has a reference to the fact that all the prophets of God, whenever made manifest unto the peoples of the world, have invariably foretold the coming of yet another prophet after them, and have established such signs as would herald the advent of the future dispensation. You can find in Abdu'l-Bahá a statement that it's a basic principle of the law of God that in every prophetic mission he entereth into a covenant with all believers, a covenant that endureth until the end of that mission, until the promised day when the personage stipulated at the outset of the mission is made manifest. That's in the Selected Writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 207. Well, it'll give you an idea of, in your own studies you can look for cross-references and find explanations of these things, either in Christian books, Islamic books. Most of the things can be answered to some degree, things that seem puzzling at first sight, by just a little extra searching around. I did most of this from books in my own house, I mean just things in the library that I have. We'll take up some of these other points next week. Keep up with your reading, and we'll come back to this. list of questions. How many of you have started working on answering the questions? Some of you? So I hope you'll look at this. Questions related to pages 1 to 49, as it will again bring you to the very points that we're discussing and focus your attention on some of these major themes that have been mentioned by Shoghi Effendi. If you want, you can put down the answer, you can quote the paragraphs. There's not space there, because some of the answers are fairly long, they're all paragraphs. But you could put page numbers and line numbers if you want, so you can find them again.